1.
This is your life.
What's that weird papery stuff inside a capacitor?
Money.
2.
This is your digital life.
Maybe we could use this printer and print standard hamburger meat.
3.
This is Spark. cbc.ca/spark.
And it's only getting bigger.
400 degrees Celsius.
Hi, I'm Nora Young. This week, two of the essentials, money and food. You'd think we worked out all the angles on making stuff to eat and spending cash, but no, tech to the rescue. If you want something different for dinner tonight, why not fire up the printer and print your food out yourself? And we look at a radical new idea for currency. Who needs governments to make it anyway? First up, just what is money on Spark? Yes, what is money? I mean, currency can seem so abstract at times. We use credit cards, debit cards, make direct bill payments and paycheck deposits through internet banking. So many of our daily transactions happen without us ever touching paper and coins. Our money is just so much data. But how did we get here? Well, first, we need to back up way up, and I'll tell you a brief history of money. This is a story of two chums, Abe.
Hey.
And B.
Hello.
Abe raised cows. B chopped wood. Abe needed wood to build a barn. B needed a cow for milk. The two traded with each other. It was barter and life was good. Years later, China. Wood wasn't enough for Abe. He wanted stone. And B was sick of milk. They couldn't trade anymore, so they had an idea.
Aha! Let's use something else instead of wooden cows,
said B. In China, they began with shells, then silver coins, and then paper money. They were the first mediums of exchange. But inflation quickly got out of control, and life wasn't that good. Years later, England. Abe had an idea.
Let's tie currency to gold,
said Abe. Paper money had no value by itself, but Abe and B promised paper could be exchanged for a certain amount of gold. It was the gold standard, and life was good. Years later, the Great Depression arrived. Abe and B were ditching the gold standard. Other countries followed, except for some, like the U.S.
I have directed Secretary Connally to suspend temporarily the convertibility of the dollar into gold or other reserve assets.
Years later, Abe and B and their chum Richard Nixon had had enough of rising inflation. The gold standard was chucked, and life was good. Years later, now, still no gold standard. Money is legally given a worth by the government, and life is good. But Abe wanted to be rich. B wanted to be richer. They started giving out mortgage loans to people who couldn't pay them. This went on and on and on till the housing bubble took everyone down with them. Abe and B and the world were in a global recession. It's the current state of affairs, and life is as good as it's going to be for now. So why are we talking about money? Well, here at Spark, we're lucky to get great story ideas from the broader Spark community. Listener Craig Dell'Andrea emailed me about a new form of digital currency called Bitcoin. Now, what Bitcoin is trying to do is get rid of the middlemen. So no transaction fees, bank rules, and no government regulation either. Sounds wacky, doesn't it? Well, that got the Spark Brain Trust curious. What makes digital currency different from conventional cash? So we sent Spark producer Anshuman Idemseti to investigate Bitcoin. Hi, Anshuman.
Hi, Nora.
So we're looking at Bitcoin as an example of virtual or digital currency. So what do we mean by this idea of digital currency?
Well, digital currency is a lot like the virtual loot you get in World of Warcraft or the Linden dollars in Second Life, right? Except that you use it outside game worlds for average transactions. I mean, you have to remember, Nora, that every transaction on credit, Farmville, over eBay, they all rest on a currency system of paper. We may use Xbox Live points to download that rad new game, but we purchase those points with conventional cash. True digital currency has no paper analog.
It's currency that isn't paper, but it is a currency that is created in a computing environment and has an acceptance.
Who was that?
That's Dr. Andrew Winston, the director of University of Texas Austin Center for Electronic Commerce. I contacted him to shed some light on digital currencies. Now, there have been other attempts at digital currency, but Bitcoin is the latest, and frankly, the smartest offering.
Okay, so what makes Bitcoin stand out?
In a word, cryptography. Bitcoin is based on a decentralized peer-to-peer network of computers. There's no central agency to oversee things, so no transaction fees, no bank tampering. Instead, the network handles money generation and transaction records collectively. Clever use of encryption keeps users from double spending, and the network itself keeps a public record of all transactions through a long chain of code blocks, where each block represents a series of transactions. Think of a very long train where new cars are built and added on with every transaction. You can't reproduce one of those cars or claim it was never built if it exists somewhere along the train line.
Okay, so Bitcoin is novel in its use of encryption for security, but that makes me wonder how safe regular old paper currency is.
Not very. We posed the same question to Dr. Winston.
Well, it's not that safe. And I think it's acknowledged. I don't think the central banks or treasuries are anxious to publicize it, but there is a lot of effort to make the paper currency more secure, and they try to move ahead of the counterfeiters. But there's probably a lot of counterfeit money just circulating.
And that's just crime. Think about the political side. Our currency model isn't safe from the artificial tinkering of governments and other financial institutions.
So this is the thing that makes it pretty radical, because Bitcoin aims to remove third parties from the banking process. So your PayPals, but also, you know, regulators like the Bank of Canada, say.
Right.
But those third parties are really the bedrock of global economics. So how does a service like Bitcoin overturn the current notion of money?
Well, money is heavily politicized, right? And on a macroeconomic level, that's just the norm. Bitcoin changes all of this. It marries a technologist's view of decentralization and anonymity with very conservative ideas on how money should be regulated. Dr. Winston sees it built on very old economic arguments.
Bitcoin has its intellectual origins to a certain extent with Milton Friedman. We should think of currency as something that facilitates transactions, and it's dangerous to let central banks to manipulate the money supply to attempt to achieve macroeconomic objectives.
Okay, so I get that it's in line with a sort of a libertarian ideology there,
right.
But regular currency, it has its value relative to other currencies. What I'm struggling with is how something like Bitcoin even, you know, how is it worth something?
Oh, right. That's a fair question. Bitcoin maintains its worth through wide acceptance by many users. I mean, take gold, for instance. Cost of its production gave it value, but short of distributed computing power, there aren't any real costs to producing a Bitcoin. And, you know, there are a variety of services already accepting Bitcoins. There's even an eBay alternative.
Really?
Yeah.
So how could I trust a system like that?
I understand it's an uphill battle, but if you think about it, all forms of currency have an implicit expectation that it's widely accepted.
I have to wonder what individual governments would make of this kind of thing. I mean, could you even tax something like Bitcoin?
You know, as it stands, no. If Bitcoin or any alternative digital currency took hold, it would essentially be one currency for the world. Here's Dr. Winston again.
There would be a common currency particular to any country. So, I mean, that's super revolutionary. You know, we've had the introduction of the euro, which eliminated local currencies in Europe. And, you know, that's still an ongoing experiment.
Dr. Winston stressed that it's also almost unthinkable for many economic pundits and politicians. You know, think about diplomacy. International relations are all about getting the best deal from others. So if a currency had zero geographic borders, zero national affiliations, it would completely redefine political bargaining power. It's pretty wild.
It sounds like Bitcoin or other digital currencies may have some trouble gaining traction.
Oh, yeah. And it isn't just resistance from central banks. The average person isn't too familiar with cryptography as a concept, right? And that's the cornerstone of Bitcoin's system. Along with global monetary reform, you'd need education and basic consumer trust.
You know, when I first started thinking about these alternative currencies, I kept trying to define what Bitcoin's inherent or intrinsic worth is, but it sounds like that isn't quite the right question.
Oh, that's right. The real question is, I guess, do conventional currencies inherently have any intrinsic worth? Dr. Winston's take?
Absolutely not. I mean, just produce the paper, and the worth is the fact that it's coin of the realm. You know, I go to the store here, and something is listed at $10, and I give the person a $10 bill. I have the right to take that product. It's the belief that others will take it.
So bottom line, what do you think the odds are that an alternate currency like Bitcoin could be successful?
Considering the overhaul, I think it can happen, but it's going to take, I guess, a multi-generational shift in thinking, right? And Dr. Winston puts it quite succinctly.
Well, I think it's a long shot, you know, that as time goes on, I'd say the odds get better as people are seeing that things are a mess in the world, and maybe it's because people who think they know everything screw up.
He's a realist, but don't knock it just yet. Going back to the World of Warcraft or Second Life examples, alternate purely digital currencies, they exist, even with their own internal economies. So it might just take a while to catch on at a global scale.
Thanks, Anshuman.
My pleasure.
That was Spark contributor and producer Anshuman Idemseti. With peer-to-peer digital currencies like Bitcoin, it seems our ideas about what money is and isn't are in flux. Take the cell phone, for example. There are countries where mobile phones are the most common medium of communication and information. And now they're being used to distribute currency. Here's Spark contributor Kai Hasselreis in Kenya.
Okay, when I say Kenya, what's the first thing you think of? Let me guess. Lions, tigers, and Maasai warriors? Well, you might want to rethink that. I'm in Kenya's capital, Nairobi. Population, 3 million. It's home to high-end malls, fancy cars, and billboards everywhere you look, advertising the latest LED TV screens. Nairobi is also the birthplace of a cell phone revolution that is changing the lives of almost every Kenyan, and could soon change yours too. I'm talking about M-Pesa. M stands for mobile. Pesa is the Swahili word for money. Mobile money. 4 years ago, a Kenyan cell phone company called Safaricom pioneered the technology. It allows its users to deposit and withdraw money on their mobiles. Now, over 70% of Kenyan households are using M-Pesa to transfer more than $350 million a month. In a country where few people have access to debit cards or the internet, but the majority have cell phones, M-Pesa is really catching on. It's not hard to find a Kenyan who uses it. I just asked the security guard at my hostel. Hello there, my name is Kai.
My name is Moses.
Hey Moses, nice to meet you.
Same to me.
I was wondering if you use M-Pesa, mobile money.
Yes, I use it.
Really? You're the first person I've asked. Tell me what you use it for.
I use it for settling my water bills, school fees, and even doing some shopping.
Like many people in Nairobi, Moses' family lives outside the city. Before M-Pesa, he had to pay for his kids' school fees by mailing his money to the village, or sending an expensive money transfer, or delivering it himself, or trusting others to deliver it for him. Mobile money is especially helpful, considering that most people in Kenya don't have a bank account. With M-Pesa, folks here can just deposit money into their phones, then transfer the money virtually from one cell phone to another.
This better because it's accessible everywhere.
And it's faster to give money.
It's faster to solve my problems because it is faster to send money.
Where can I get M-Pesa?
You get it around here, even where I am here.
Oh, just across the street?
Across the street, yes.
Oh, okay. Thank you for your help.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thanks for keeping me safe here at the hostel.
Also, me, I appreciate that.
There are 19,000 M-Pesa agents in Kenya, including a little pharmacy right across from my hostel. Hello there. My name is Kai. What's your name?
I'm Penina.
Okay. How can I get M-Pesa on my phone?
First of all, the first requirement is you need to be registered. You need to have a Safaricom SIM card. And then, are you registered?
It's remarkably easy and quick to register for M-Pesa. All I need to do is fill out a form. Then, using her cell phone, Penina calls Safaricom to register my details.
Penina. And your PIN is secret. You're not supposed to tell anyone your PIN. Once you register M-Pesa, it's like having your own bank account in your phone.
Okay. I just got a message on my phone saying your M-Pesa account is now active. So now what do? And now I give you money and put money on it.
Yeah. You can give me money now.
Okay. Here, I will give you 800 Kenyan shillings. That's around the same as 10 Canadian dollars.
Yeah, that's 800. Okay. Now I'm sending the message to Safaricom. then they're going to give me an answer, and the message will also come to your phone. Yes.
My message says, money confirmed, balance is 800 Kenyan shillings. So I just gave you 800 Kenyan shillings, and you put it on my phone, is that right?
Yes, I did.
What I think is amazing about this is that you didn't even use a computer to put money on my phone. You just used your phone, right?
Yes, I just used my agent phone.
Did I pay anything to do this transaction?
No. To deposit money is free of charge. What is charged is when you are transferring the money or when you are withdrawing the money.
What about you as an M-Pesa agent? Are you making any money?
Yes, we make money.
And how does that happen?
We get some commissions from Safaricom.
Oh. And how is that helpful for you?
Yes, it is. It's good business.
Thank you very much for all your help.
You're welcome.
Do you stop at Sachi Plaza? I want to know more about M-Pesa and its potential. So I ask around for a good person to give me the big picture. Next thing you know, I'm taking a bus to an office complex not far from my hostel. I've got an appointment with a local tech expert.
My name is Moses Kemibaro, and I'm currently the regional manager for dealfish.co.ke. Well, I've been working in technology in Kenya and the broader East African region now for close to 15 years. More recently, blogging quite considerably on my blog at moseskemibaro.com.
Should Canadians be surprised that this kind of technology revolution is happening in a country like Kenya?
Well, I think it's taken a lot of people by surprise, including ourselves down here. If you look at Kenya right now, we're talking about the odd, 4 to 6 million internet users. We've got the 22 million odd mobile users. And all these things, plus the broadband, all these elements coming together really are creating almost like a pot of innovation.
Moses Kemibaro is right. Kenya really is unique. Only 10% of people here are online, but over 60% have cell phones. He says M-Pesa is spreading to other countries with similar stats.
Well, you find M-Pesa now is actually available in countries like South Africa. I think it's in Pakistan. You'll find it in Tanzania, Uganda, and it's only getting bigger. The next step, I think, is really how far can it go in terms of how much can we plug it into other things. And I think one of the areas where that's happening is the internet. Being able to actually use M-Pesa as your virtual credit card or e-commerce facilitator on a sort of a Pan-African basis. I remember one instance when I was in Uganda and I missed a flight and I had to actually find a way to get back to Nairobi the same day. And the only way it was possible was actually I was able to actually get money from my bank account into my M-Pesa account, pay Kenya Airways the difference, then get an SMS from them with a new ticket number, which allowed me to fly back to Kenya on time. And that's how convenient it is. I mean, you can literally use it on the move.
After my visit to Moses Kemibaro, I decide to take a taxi home. Guess how I pay? Okay, now I enter the amount I owe you. So how much do I owe you?
So you owe me 500.
So I just type in 500?
Yeah. Then okay.
Oh, okay, I got a message.
I got a message too.
Okay, good. So I just paid for my cab ride with M-Pesa.
Yeah. So now you're free to go. Thank you.
All I need to do to pay my taxi fare is get out my phone, open the M-Pesa account, and send 500 shillings from my phone to my cabbies. I wonder if I'll ever be able to do this in Canada. Unlike most Kenyans, we have access to plastic. Lots of it. And internet transactions are quick and easy. But based on my experience with M-Pesa, paying for things with my phone is even more convenient. For Spark, I'm Kai Hasselreis in Nairobi.
So Kai wonders if he'll ever be able to use a mobile payment system here in Canada. And we wondered the exact same thing. So to find out, we called up this guy.
My name is David Schrofer. I am a partner at the Luciana Group, which is a international consulting firm.
David pays very close attention to the mobile payment industry around the world. He kind of wrote the book on what they could mean for consumers.
I'm also the author of The Smartphone Wallet, Understanding the Disruption Ahead.
David sees real potential for these systems in North America.
Mobile payments and the mobile wallet represents the largest single opportunity for consumers to save money that is likely to occur in your lifetime or mine.
And there's a lot of work going into these systems from companies you've probably heard of.
Companies like Visa and MasterCard.
And from companies you may never have heard of.
Like First Data and Fidelity.
And a host of startups like Square and Paydiant. New technologies like NFC, near field communication, are being built into smartphones. And there's a lot of buzz around mobile payments. But David says there are some challenges in the way of mass adoption. First, in order for North Americans to want to use a mobile payment system, it has to be better than all the other ways we already have to pay for stuff. In a cash-based society like Kenya, where poverty is high and few people have bank accounts, M-Pesa has clear advantages. It's simply a better alternative to cash. But in North America, we have a lot of alternatives for moving money. Debit cards, credit cards, direct deposit.
The average is consumers have 4.3 different credit cards and debit cards in their wallet at any given moment in time. Plus, they have cash as an alternative, checks as an alternative. So there are a significant number of substitutes, which, by the way, we're all comfortable with. We've used them for years. We know how they work. We know what to expect.
So the attitude, at least among consumers, is,
why try something different? We have something that works.
So that's part of the challenge, being better than what's already out there. Another challenge also has to do with vested interests. A lot of companies make a lot of money by processing transactions. Part of what's so revolutionary about a system like M-Pesa is that it's peer-to-peer. The cost of transferring money is so low because it cuts out the middlemen. But of course, middlemen like being in the middle. Here in North America, none of the middlemen want to give up their share of the pie.
And by not giving up their piece of the pie, it's possible that we don't get to leverage the advantages that have been illustrated to us by a product like M-Pesa.
David says this could go one of two ways. We could end up with just one more version of the North American status quo, a credit or debit card, but built into our smartphones. Or we could end up with a truly revolutionary peer-to-peer mobile payment system.
So if customers can get used to using new forms of payment outside of the typical credit card and debit card model, then the consumers stand to win.
The other barrier to mass adoption that David told us about has to do with security. I know people who took years to warm up to the idea of online banking. How do you convince people that it's safe to pay for things with a phone?
It's interesting. When we look at that issue in this industry, there are actually two issues. There's actual security and perceived security. Those people that took 10 years to adopt online banking in one way or another, likely that was either a discomfort with the medium, they weren't used to using it, or they had concerns about security and people stealing their money in some way. Most of the services that are either available to you and I today or will be available to you and I in the next 2 or 3 years are substantially more secure through a mobile phone than any piece of plastic available today. There's almost no way that a plastic card can have the same levels of security that we are talking about putting into smartphones over the next few years. Convincing consumers of that is going to be a very different matter. Proving to consumers that the security levels using a smartphone are significantly higher than the security levels using a piece of plastic will take some time.
So which way will it go? The way of M-Pesa in Kenya or the way the incumbents want things to be? The good news is that the choice is up to you and me.
This is all up to consumers. Whether mobile payments turns out to be a benefit to consumers or a detriment to consumers is actually up to consumers. Everybody in my profession is looking very closely at those products that are getting attention from consumers today versus those products that are not. And on a commercial level, when we see a product that seems to be working, like M-Pesa in Africa and some of the other products that are getting some traction here, like Bling, for example, like ZoomPass, which is born out of Endstream, a Canadian company. We look very closely at what's working and what's not working because that helps us understand what the potential of that product is over time.
David Schroefer is the author of The Smartphone Wallet, Understanding the Disruption Ahead. I'd love to know what you think. What kinds of mobile payment systems would you be comfortable or not comfortable using? Let me know. Send me an email, spark@cbc.ca, or leave a comment at the blog, cbc.ca/spark.